Well, hello and grace and peace to you. This is your priest and pastor at the Fort Church of St. Martin's Parish, Father Nick. And as always, I've got with me the Reverend Dr. Ross Wright. So happy to have him to discuss how did we get the New Testament. But we also have a special guest with us, and that's the Reverend Dr. Andy Guffey. Andy is a longtime friend of mine. I knew him when he was a graduate student working on his PhD at UVA, and I was doing campus ministry as a university chaplain at UVA. And since then, he's gone on to get his PhD in New Testament studies and also be ordained and become a colleague, which is really wonderful. And he now serves a church and teaches. So Andy, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Ross, as always, thank you for joining me in this conversation.
It's a pleasure to be with you guys. Thank you, Nick.
So we're going to be talking about Hebrews, the book of Hebrews, and the revelation of John, or sometimes known as the Apocalypse of John. But before we move into that, I wanted to bring up one of the questions after our last discussion when we talked about the Gospel of Thomas. Was why spend, so here we are, we're about to spend one session on two books that are actually in the New Testament. And last week we spent one whole session on a book that is not in the New Testament. And so why did we do that? Why spend time on that book? And one of the reasons that came up in our discussion, I just want to kind of lift up here in this recording, is that by looking at a possibly early book, since most of the books that, quote, didn't make it into the New Testament came late, much later than the books that did make it into the New Testament, by looking at the Gospel of Thomas, we were looking at a possibly early book that at least in some form may have gone back to the time that the New Testament texts were written, and yet was not determined to be scripturally authoritative, a faithful witness, and even was warned against by certain church fathers. There's been all sorts of discussion about why these church fathers did not consider it to be edifying and authoritative. I think some of the reasons that have been put forward are better than others. One of the reasons that I've lifted up and I'd like to lift up again is I think that, and Andy or Ross, if y'all have any thoughts on this too, before we move into Hebrews, I'd love to hear it. But I think that one of the reasons why it really kind of just didn't work for these church fathers is that it had no, I already dispelled last week the idea that it was a quote unquote Gnostic text. So it's not Gnostic, that's not why it was rejected, but it didn't present a fleshly, down in the dirt, incarnate, living, you know, Jesus, who is living among us, who lived with us, who then, and this is perhaps most important, who died for us, who actually bled and died on the cross, and then was raised. It never speaks against this image, but it also never presents Jesus in this way, and begins by saying that it's a text about the hidden teachings of the living Jesus. As if the Jesus of the second century, when the Gospel of Thomas took the form that it did, this living Jesus is more important than whoever that guy was walking the dusty roads of Galilee 100 years before. And that, you know, nothing about his particular life or death has really any meaning for us. And this also meant that Thomas, the Gospel of Thomas, was willing to be more cavalier with the sayings of Jesus in terms of developing them into new teachings for the Christians of that day, rather than feeling any need to kind of stay anchored in the historical past. Andy and Ross, does that seem right to you, or do you have any other thoughts on that before we move into Hebrews?
Yes, yeah, that's a very eloquent way of stating the difference between the Jesus of the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels and John, this lack of enfleshment. One other observation, just a practical observation about why I spend time reading the Gospel of Thomas, has to do with just the variation of expressions of Christianity that were going on in the early, end of the apostolic period and into the second century. We often refer to Christianity as if it were a monolithic phenomenon, but there were, I think in some ways it's probably true to say that there were Christianities, not that they were totally opposed to each other, but there were really significant differences in emphases. And it took a while for what we think of as Catholic Christianity, the universal church, to emerge. And so I think it's, for this reason, valuable to study something like the Gospel of Thomas to see a variation on what we tend to think of as standard Christianity. It was actually quite varied at the period that we're looking at.
Yeah, sometimes when I've taught the Gospel of Thomas, for undergraduates especially, I say, okay, is this Christianity? We read the, like, is this a Christian document? And, you know, many of them who were raised Christian, reading the Bible, I don't know. Like, of course it's Christian. It might be weird Christian to you, but of course it's another version of Jesus followers and what they found valuable in the life and teachings of Jesus. But I think you're right, Nick. I think that's as Ross said, that's an eloquent way of putting the difference between kind of the canonical gospels. You know, I had a teacher once who said that synoptics are very much, you know, human Jesus, and John kind of, Jesus kind of swoops down, but never quite touches down and then lifts back off again. But I think if that's true of John, it's true in spades of Thomas. Jesus is never really quite human in a recognizable way. He's always a little, he shifts the sands shift underneath you. Just when you think you're getting a familiar saying from the Jesus tradition, all of a sudden at the end, it's just like a little twist and like, what? so yeah, I think that's exactly what gave the church fathers the heebie-jeebies, so to speak, about the Gospel of Thomas.
Yeah, so if John kind of swoops down and then back up, the Jesus of the Gospel of Thomas keeps soaring above and way to end up to him.
Kind of peeks down occasionally, like, hello.
you might get some droppings from the...
there you go.
Well, so one of the reasons why I wanted to bring that up is if you look through the New Testament really does, almost every text stresses either the kind of incarnational, that is the fleshly, the human nature of Jesus, that he really was one of us, or it stresses the death on a cross, the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus. One exception that comes to mind is the epistle of James. But James actually had a hard time, as we talked about when we discussed James, securing its place in the canon. And that may have been part of the reason. And I think had going for it, this claim to be written by Jesus's own brother, and a kind of commitment to what would become a normative Christianity. But this kind of helps us to, I think, take the turn and look at Hebrews, Because here's a text that has elements that I think would, you know, well, let's just put it this way. It's got a lot of Hellenistic philosophy in it, a lot of Plato's philosophical understanding of reality kind of woven into it, which is something that, you know, at least an earlier generation of New Testament scholars would have automatically linked with something like Gnosticism or the Gospel of Thomas. And yet Hebrews is securely placed in our canon. And I think because in part it takes such a kind of deep dive into the very crucifixion of Jesus. It mentions the resurrection, but really focuses, even in a way that you don't see in Paul's letters, on Jesus's sacrificial death on the cross. And so even though it has this Hellenistic philosophy, this Hellenistic, by the way, is just a term meaning essentially Greek in the first century, Greek culture, Greek thought. So it has this Greek philosophical thought woven into it. Its focus on Jesus's crucifixion, I think, is one of the reasons why it's unquestionably in the canon. So let's talk about Hebrews. Andy, who do you think wrote Hebrews?
I have no idea. you know, one of the best gifts that I ever had as a scholar was an Old Testament professor at Candler School of Theology, who John Hayes, who passed a few years ago. And he very often, he had a thick Alabama accent. And if anybody's from Alabama watching this, I apologize for the quality of my Alabama accent. But he would say, now who wrote, this thing in Isaiah? Or he'd say, you know, why did they write it like this? And we'd all, you know, scratch our heads like, oh my God, we got to have the right answer. And somebody would offer an answer like, nope. And he'd tell us why not that. And how about this? Well, probably not. And here's why. And you're like, anybody else? Crickets. And then he'd say, well, we don't know. Like, so great gift to occasionally be able to say, I don't know. Of course, it's traditionally, and by traditionally, I mean, if there's a majority opinion in the tradition of the church and the way that the letter to the Hebrews, which isn't actually a letter, but we'll get into that in a second, has been collected into the canon. It was collected along with Paul's letters and then thought to be by Paul, but not for very long. Origen, already in the third century, spotted pretty clearly, this does not sound like Paul at all. And it didn't originally circulate, apparently, with his letters. And so the traditional attribution of Hebrews to Paul isn't even all that traditional, but certainly is incorrect. There have been some strong minority opinions. I think it was Luther who said it was, who thought maybe it was by Apollos, this figure from that we learn about in Acts and in 1 Corinthians, who is very eloquent in Greek, and the Greek of Hebrews is majestic. If you need a reason to learn biblical Greek, it's so that you can read Hebrews. Anyway, but yeah, so all of that to say, we don't really know. It's clearly a document from the first century, and clearly someone who is very skilled in oratory and learned. The references to the Jewish scriptures just infuse the book. You mentioned Greek philosophy. Certainly there's rhetoric here, but it's all through the prism of the Jewish scriptures and the Hebrew Bible and the Old Testament. And so so it's really one of the gems of New Testament compositions. But we don't have any idea who wrote it. But Ross, I'll kick it to you if you want to say anything about that.
Yeah, one of the fun things about Hebrews and the authorship question is how many different candidates there have been for possible authorship. In addition to Apollos, Priscilla and Aquila was one theory. Adolf von Harnack emphasizing the Priscilla part of the team. We talked about Apollos. Calvin suggested either Luke or Clement of Rome. So there's just this extraordinary profusion of theories about authorship, and I think it just simply underscores what Andy's already said, that we simply don't know. God only knows who wrote the Epistle to the Hebrews, according to Origen. Kind of a nice way to summer.
Yeah, that's great. The Origen, after considering the possibility of Paul and saying, doesn't sound like Paul, that his response for us, as you said, was, well, God only knows who wrote it. And nobody's come up with a better answer since.
No.
So one of the things, Andy, that you mentioned is that, though we often refer to it in our Bibles as the Epistle to the Hebrews or the Letter to the Hebrews, it actually doesn't seem to be that. It seems to be missing some of the things. And this is one of the reasons, for example, that people don't think it was from Paul, is that Paul likes to begin in the standard Hellenistic letter format, saying who he is and to whom he's writing. And there's nothing like that. So what if it's not a letter? What is it?
It's pretty clearly some sort of exhortation, a sermon, if you will, or a treatise even. But it's so rhetorically polished that this must have been something like a standard, I'm guessing, as a standard sort of thing to read out loud. And remember, all of these readings were done out loud. But it's a fine piece of oratory that was clearly meant to do many things for its audience. But exactly right. There's no Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ, with Timothy to the... None of that. It just starts, long ago, God spoke to our ancestors in many and various ways. And in the Greek, it's even more palumeros kai palai lalesos hotheos tois patrosin in tois prophetais. And there's a whole lot of there's a lot of alliteration, and it just is gorgeous. And not the sort of thing you get in a letter where Paul's like, here's who I am, here's who you are, I'm writing to you, I'm giving thanks for you, here's a little bit about what I'm going to say, and then there's the body of the letter. Much more prosaic than what we get in Hebrews. So yeah, I'd say this is an exhortation, a speech.
That's what it calls itself, right? In
yes.
Chapter 13, verse 22, because it does kind of have a sign off there at the end.
Right, right.
Which does kind of make it sound a little bit like a letter, but may just be, the tag as this gets sent out to other, Christian churches to be read aloud in their right. churches. And it says, I appeal to you, sisters and brothers, bear with my word of exhortation, for I have written to you briefly.
Right. And this is the one part where people think it might be by Paul, because he mentions Timothy.
I don't have the Greek in front of me. What this word exhortation is in Greek? Do you know that?
Yeah, I probably should just know what it is. But I'll look it up just to be on the safe side. But in the meantime,
yeah, Ross, any thoughts on this as a sermon?
Yeah, I certainly concur with what's been said about it not being a standard epistolary form. It does have some kind of personal references. We talked, for example, about some of you have suffered, but not to the point of death. So the writer gives the impression of having some personal knowledge of the addressees. So it does seem to be an exhortation or a moral sermon to people that he has some knowledge of. So it's a little bit of a hybrid form, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Yeah, do you guys see that? I mean, as you read through it, does it strike you as someone who had knowledge of the recipients or not?
Yeah, although I would say that's also standard in rhetoric. It's clearly not meant to be a universal sort of piece. It's clearly got a defined audience. But it's also the case that the orator would build rapport with their audience through some of these sorts of devices. But you're right that that models or that that links very closely to the sorts of things that we find in letters also. And so there is an there does feel like, I think maybe what you're saying, and I agree with completely, is that there is an occasional sort of feel to it, that there is a reason that this writer is and perhaps sending this piece of oratory in written form rather than showing up and delivering it in person. Absolutely.
Well, and in that sense, there's a connection a little bit with say the letters of Paul, discounting for a moment the whether Paul wrote them or not, the pastoral epistles, which are directed towards individuals. When he writes to, say, the church in Rome or the church in Galatia or something, you know, it's a letter, but it's also a letter meant to be read aloud to the assembly. So it has a kind of exhortatory or hortatory kind of, you know, even his letters kind of carry that style in some sense with them. Did you find the word?
Yeah, so it's a logos tes parakleseos, which is to say a word of comfort. And so that's the exhortation in the sense of paraklesis. I mean, everybody, probably we can figure out what paraklesis. So the comforter in John's gospel, the paraclete, this sense of comforting is sort of what the epistle is meant to convey, which goes back to, you know, Ross was talking about some of you have suffered but not yet to death, that there does seem to be something disturbing the community that he's writing to, and he's writing in part at least, and we think it's a he, it's possible it's a she. This is one of the few writings where we're like, well, we don't know, so all bets are off. But writing to a community in order to kind of ground their faith ever further in what they've received and in Christ, who walks through every page, as it were.
Yeah. Well, we're starting to transition into talking about the themes here, and so I want to do that, but before we do, that very same Greek phrase, this word of exhortation, or as you say, word of comfort, that phrase shows up in the book of Acts, also in chapter 13 in Acts. Verse 15 reads, after the reading of the law and the prophets, the rulers of the synagogue sent to them saying, brethren, if you have any word of exhortation, so there's that phrase right there, any word of exhortation for the people, say it. And then verse 16, so Paul stood up and motioning with his hand said, and then we get essentially a sermon from Paul in Acts. So there we see that phrase used specifically in connection with a sermon.
And with Paul.
And
then linked again to Timothy here at the end.
Right.
You know, a critical scholar might even suggest that part of the reason this got kind of lumped in with Paul is because of these brief mentions here at the end that seem to resonate with Paul in Acts and his connection to Timothy.
Yeah, great. Thank you for lifting that up. Ross, as we move into discussion of themes, Andy's already kind of hinted at, and actually both of you have hinted at there being some kind of persecution or time of trouble that the community has gone through. So that's one of the themes. Did you want to say a little bit more about that, or did you want to say something about some of the other themes that are important in the text?
I think I'll mention some other themes that strike me or stand out as I read the text. I think it was Calvin who pointed out that the theme of the finality of Christ, because of his work on the cross, comes across with great power in this epistle. The gospel of Christ is presented as the last word in terms of our needs because of Christ's work. And what's particularly striking about the emphasis on Christ's work in Hebrews is the priesthood of Christ, how Christ continues to intercede for us, intercede before the Father on our behalf. And again, I think it was Calvin who pointed out that there's really no letter in the New Testament that says with such force and such clarity what Christ is doing for us now, which I think is a very striking way to think about the atonement, the atoning work of Christ. It's easy to think of it as something in the past that happened at a moment. And certainly the writer of the Hebrews emphasizes the once and for all nature of Christ's death, but this extension of the atonement into the present, where the Christ is interceding for us as the priest, I always find that a very striking theme in Hebrews when I read it, and what comes to mind when I think about the major themes.
So I wonder if there's a connection in that sense that Hebrews is making between the suffering that the people to whom this word of comfort is being addressed, their suffering and the redemptive suffering of Christ on the cross. Andy, do you think that's a connection we're supposed to draw there?
I think I'm not sure it goes quite that far. I mean, that would be a pretty fulsome theology of the cross as we find it in St. Jürgen Moltmann, perhaps. But in some ways, the Christ, the mediator, makes, and the great high priest makes, that suffering makes the present suffering endurable, but not because there's a kind of, I think, identification of the two, but because Christ's suffering secures a better future, if that makes sense. At least that's, I'm a little bit rusty on Hebrews, I'm gonna admit, but that's my reading of Hebrews, is that in many ways, maybe I'll put it this way, in many ways, if there is a connection, what the author of Hebrews, I think, is trying to do is take the experience of persecution or of, that's a big word that is probably best left to the side for a second, but their discomfort or they're being troubled. And instead of dwelling on it, shoves them past that toward Christ and toward the work of the great high priest in the heavens, in the new covenant, in the new temple, and all of these kind of new pressing forward sorts of language that Hebrews brings in. So I think insofar as it utilizes that suffering, it does so to only as background and backdrop to pushing them toward refocusing their attention, not on their suffering, but on Christ.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to suggest that we smuggle process theology back the first time. No, I definitely think it's a Platonic kind of perspective. And I mean, in some sense, you use Paul's language, the suffering of this present age isn't worth comparing to the glory that shall be revealed to us. And I was just trying to kind of tease out, maybe there's this kind of connection of, you're going through the suffering, but don't worry, there's one who has made satisfaction for you.
And all of that bringing back in a very rich way, the sacrificial system of the Jewish scriptures and of the temple, as it was imagined, this is a bone of contention among various scholars. Was the temple still standing? Was the temple cult still in operation or not? I tend to think it was not. I tend to think this was written after 70, but and 70 being when the temple was destroyed by the Romans. And so I tend to think that this is more of a reimagination of the sacrificial system in a more, hesitate to use the word mythological, but if we say apocalyptic or theological direction imagining what the liturgy of the heavens is like, which is the theme we'll pick up again probably in the book of Revelation. It really tries to kind of elevate beyond present circumstance to see the great power and the work of Christ, even in his role as sacrificial victim and also as priest.
Yeah, and you lifted up a good point that we should probably take a minute to discuss, which is the question of when was this written? And this, you know, the consensus seems to be first century, but the range seems to be anywhere from about 60 to about 80 or 90 in mm-hmm. the first century. And one of the big questions is, because it spends so much time on the temple cult, the sacrifices in the temple, as you said, and the temple was destroyed in 70 AD or CE of the first century. Those who think that that it's reflecting on a temple still in practice will date it before that, and they'll say, well, if it was written afterwards, surely it would have mentioned the destruction of the temple. And then those who would date it after that event probably point out that, you get the most rabbinic writing on the temple after it's been destroyed. And nobody talks about when it was destroyed. They get into all the different, discussion of the temple practices as if it's still running because of its powerful symbolic import. Ross, did you have any thoughts on that?
The commentary that I looked at in preparation for our session is by F.F. Bruce, and he tries to locate the date of Hebrews by tracking what's described internally in the document with what we know about persecution through the various Roman emperors. The waves of persecution came, and we'll maybe talk about this some more when we talk about Revelation. But often there's a big demarcation between what's often referred to as official state-sponsored persecution, where it's illegal to be a Christian by virtue of your beliefs because the worship of the emperor has become so prominent, as opposed to earlier, where there are these spasmodic outbreaks of persecution, but it doesn't seem to be systematic or organized. And F.F. Bruce reads Hebrews, particularly a verse like the one I referenced earlier, you have suffered, but not to the point of death, as evidence that it was in this earlier period, so around 64. But that's, I don't have a very strong, well-informed opinion. That makes sense to me that it would be before 70. But what do you think, Nick?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we see is that really when it's talking about the temple, it's actually talking more about the description of the movable tabernacle when they're wandering in the wilderness and then later first settling Canaan and not the physical structure, permanent structure that was destroyed in 70. Maybe I'll just go with Origen, adapt the date and say God only knows. We're going to have to wrap up soon on Hebrews so that we have enough time to talk about Revelation. But there's so many important themes in here, and they end up informing, I think, liturgy in a lot of ways. Notion of Christ's sacrifice as being the true sacrifice and all of the sacrifices of the temple as being kind of a foreshadowing of or just shadows of the true sacrifice of Christ. You know, on the one hand, this draws on, again, a lot of that Hellenistic or Middle Platonic philosophy, so that the most real thing is not the kind of day-to-day physical activities of the material world, but the much, the kind of eternal spiritual kind of events that of which the day-to-day things of, you know, the material world and its time are mere reflections or shadows of. And so we get this language of Christ being the one, you know, the one true sacrifice. He's the one true high priest, the one true sacrifice. He's the high priest who sacrifices himself. And here in that we get something that we don't see as much of in other New Testament texts, which is the Messiah as a what's known as an Aaronic, that is a Messiah after the first high priest, Moses' brother Aaron, an Aaronic Messiah or a priestly Messiah, but it's not his his priestly lineage can't be traced to Aaron. And so we have the invocation of a kind of mysterious figure from Genesis, the priest king Melchizedek, which we may want to say a little bit more about before we move on. But this language of the one sacrifice once offered became really important in the Reformation as Luther was trying to distance his views of the Eucharist from the views of the Roman Church and their emphases on Eucharist as sacrificial rite. And therefore it makes its way into the language of our Book of Common Prayer in the Episcopal Church, where in Rite 1, we have these words that are allusions to Hebrews about Christ being the one sacrifice once offered, the, you know, one perfect oblation, and so on. But I can keep going on this. I'd rather turn it over to you guys. Andy, did you want to say anything about Melchizedek or about this eternal once for all sacrifice of Christ?
Melchizedek is interesting because we don't know much about Melchizedek. There's just this mention of Melchizedek in the Hebrew scriptures kind of briefly and his connection to Abraham. But Hebrews uses that to kind of give Christ priority, to kind of reinstall Christ. I mean, another way this happens in early Christian writings is to place Christ at the foundation of the world or in the creation itself with John's prologue, for instance. Any way that Christians could find a way to, this is a crass way of putting it, but to trump Jewish tradition or to reinsert Christ at the beginning or throughout Jewish tradition, which is exactly what Hebrews is doing consistently all the way through. But this is one place where this blessing is given by Melchizedek, and that's really all we know. And then Hebrews takes it and says, and see, so even this Abrahamic tradition, even all of this Jewish tradition is still, there's a prior priesthood, and that's the priesthood of Melchizedek. And Jesus is a priest after this order, and so not subject to Jewish tradition, but in fact gives it its the blessing, which is one of the things I think we probably ought to talk about a little bit is the way that Jewish tradition is handled here, and this big word supersessionism. Does Christianity supersede Judaism? Does God, and this is a theological problem throughout the New Testament writings as well, does God invalidate the first covenant in order to validate a second covenant. And I think there are a couple of ways this gets answered in early Christianity, but I think what Hebrews does, and it's often seen as a very supersessionist work that says everything is old and passed away, and there are some elements of that. But at the same time, it gives a certain validity in a Christian framework to the Jewish tradition, precisely because it links Christ consistently back to that tradition. And without that tradition, you've got no letter to the Hebrews or exhortation to the Hebrews. And so it's a way of both validating Jewish tradition and trying to lift Christ as kind of the font of that tradition and the head of that tradition, sort of like the Jesus saying from the Gospels, the man was not created for the Sabbath, but the Sabbath for man. And the Lord is the Lord of the Sabbath. Same principle here, that the Lord is, that the Christ is the Lord of the Jewish tradition. And he does that in this, the author does that in a very clever way by going back to this kind of obscure figure of Melchizedek.
I think that's good. I'm glad that you brought that up. We've tried to be attentive, Ross and I have, to the ways that supersessionism and anti-Judaism can be drawn out of and read out of some of these texts. And that really lays, I think, the responsibility on us as contemporary Christians. We can read these passages in such a way and focus on these passages, you know, certain verses in such a way that we construct a supersessionist theology now, that is a theology that sees Christianity as not just growing out of this Jewish tradition that also produced rabbinic Judaism, but as replacing that and kind of co-opting that tradition. We can read it in that way. And I think we would be wrong to do that. I would go so far as to say it would be sinful to do that, though that has often happened in the history of the church. Or we can read these texts, as you were suggesting, Andy, as actually kind of directing us to our great debt to this tradition, this Jewish tradition, and our need to be in dialogue with Jews and Jewish thinkers even today to better understand ourselves, but also God's word and revelation to his people Israel, and by extension through Christ to his people the church. So thank you for raising that up. Ross, and any other thoughts? Because we're going to have to move on.
Nope, can't say it better than that.
There's more that we could say. Andy?
Could I just add one thing? And I'll make this as brief as possible. So I think this all comes to, you can see all of this at work, and also the beauty and power of Hebrews in chapter 12, where he begins with, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and the sin that clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who for the sake of the joy that was set before him endured the cross, disregarding its shame, and has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of God. And goes on. It's really hard to excerpt Hebrews, by the way, because it's so pieced together. And so it talks about enduring trials and all of that, and then says in verse 18, for you have not come to something that can be touched, a blazing fire and darkness and gloom and a tempest, and the sound of a trumpet and a voice whose words made the hearers beg that not another word be spoken to them, for they could not endure the order that was given. If even an animal touches the mountain, it shall be stoned to death. Indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I tremble with fear, but you have come to Mount Zion, and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn, and on and on and on. And so he takes, in just the span of a few verses, the sufferings of those he's talking to, links it to Christ's suffering, and then moves it straight on into Mount Zion. And without Mount Zion, without any of this understanding of what Mount Zion represents, the presence of God, the power, the benevolence, the grace of God, and this notion that the mountain is surrounded by this angelic company, with angels and archangels and with all the company of heaven, as it were, this is your reality, the author of Hebrews is saying. This is the life you are actually living. This is what the world actually looks like. And it's all based in this Jewish tradition, and without it. So this is the power, I think, of Hebrews, and it's just magnificent. That's
it. Thank you. Yeah, I think we're all in agreement on that. So if I can try and shoehorn a segue here, another text that draws heavily on previous Jewish scriptures or texts that are in the Tanakh or the Septuagint is the book of Revelation, though very different texts that it draws on. It draws on the apocalyptic literature of the Septuagint or the Tanakh. That would be books like Daniel and Ezekiel and some parts of Isaiah. But since those are difficult books in themselves to understand, it makes the revelation to John of Patmos or the Apocalypse of John an equally difficult text to understand, which is why we brought in the expert, Andy. This text says that it was written by a John of Patmos. Who is he, and is he related to the John of the Johannine literature that we've already discussed?
Okay, so you'll remember my Old Testament professor. Well, we don't know. So here's what I can tell you, though. This John has traditionally been understood to be also the John the Evangelist and John the author of the epistles. And in Orthodox tradition, he goes by the name John the Theologian, who is a title only given to him and two others, John the Theologian, Gregory the Theologian, and Simeon the New Theologian. And that was a bit of a slur at the time. So really, Gregory of Nazianzen is the other, and he was a pivotal figure in the formulation of Trinitarian orthodoxy, and that's how he got his title. The gospel and the apocalypse and the letters together, this John has traditionally been understood to be John the Apostle. However, scholars aren't so sure. The language between the book of Revelation and the gospel of John is just very different Greek. The Greek of Revelation is choppy. It very much sounds like Greek is his second language or third or something. Whereas the Gospel of John flows pretty nicely and has some even very eloquent parts. So most scholars think now that in fact, maybe none of these writings were written by the same John, and maybe none of them were even written by John the Apostle, but took the name of John. And that there may be a whole school of Johannine students and authors and writers. Let's stick to Revelation. Now, in Revelation, he actually identifies himself as John in three different places. I, John, was on the island of Patmos. So we assume his name is John. And that he is active somehow as a pastor in Asia Minor, which is current-day Turkey, and these cities that he's writing to. That he's currently on the island of Patmos, and that's about all we got in terms of identifying him in the historical record, as it were. Ross, I'll kick it to you if you want to add anything in there.
No, it's really helpful. Just to reiterate on what you've already said, there are all these different theories. You know, there are many different marks that are, or Johns rather, that are identified in the New Testament, or several, right? There's the John Mark, who was a traveling companion of Paul and Barnabas. There were some early readers of Revelation who associated the John of Revelation with this John Mark. There's the John the Elder. Another theory that was put forward, again, this is just, I don't believe this theory, but it's just helpful to kind of get a sense of the range of things. One scholar argued that the disciples of John the Baptist created this community of interpretation that produced an apocalyptic document. And so this scholar argues that there was a Jewish apocalyptic document included in the canon, a bit far-fetched, really. So it just shows you the range of options as people have struggled to try to identify who this person is. I was to come back to something I said when we were talking about the Epistles of John, the Gospel of John. This idea Luke Timothy Johnson articulates in his book, A Short Introduction to the New Testament, that there were these communities throughout Asia Minor that traced their identity back to the Apostle John, but were actually documents were written by different people. That's the theory that makes the most sense to me, that there's this varying communities that all have a kind of central origin, but documents written by different authors and addressing somewhat different situations.
Well, so that raises an interesting question, which is the text begins with, you know, mentioning these letters that that Christ is instructing John of Patmos to send out, seven letters to the seven churches. And yet this book itself is not a letter, though it contains the I guess the contents of those letters. So were those real letters that were sent out, or is that a literary device? I'm asking the expert.
Okay. I'll take the lead on this. Fine. I'm trying to share time. I'm trying not to. The genre of this book is difficult to pin down, because on the one hand, scholars want to say, well, this is clearly an apocalypse, as you said, like Daniel, like some of the works, the Enochic works that aren't in our Bibles, like 4th Ezra, 2nd Baruch, and some of these other writings. But this notion of apocalypse as a literary genre is a very modern one, and modeled after the Apocalypse of John. That's how the genre gets its name. So it's a little difficult, because letter is an ancient genre as well, that had pretty stable rules and all that. So it's a little bit letter, it's a little bit apocalypse, and then what it calls itself is a prophecy, which is slightly different yet from an apocalypse. So nailing down the exact genre is kind of funky, but also beyond that, these letters are all pretty well contained, are all contained to the first few chapters. And it would be pretty easy to lop off chapters 1 through 3 and kind of the end of and chapter part of chapter 22 and just have this middle section from chapter 4 through the first part of chapter 22 and have a pretty coherent apocalypse or prophecy. So there is a scholarly theory that indeed only in the second or another recension of the book did these letters get added. Now, were these, your question though was, are they real letters? And the answer is, well, we don't know. Anyway, so, but to the, what sort of considerations are there? Well, these aren't full letters. They're very truncated. They're very brief. They don't include basic sections that we would expect of a letter that was actually sent. And they link one to another. There are linking words throughout that tie them together and tie them into chapter 4 and the vision of the throne room. So these are clearly a literary set of letters, which might have been intended to address specific situations, like in Pergamon, there's a note, the notice of, and his name went right out of my head, who, my faithful servant who has clearly been killed. And so there do seem to be some local situations that the author is addressing. However, they all seem to go together. So it would be easy to see how this could be, these letters could be addressing each of these seven, the communities in these seven cities, but being sent circularly so that all of the letters are really intended for all of them. But not as individual letters, but as part of a larger composition.
I think before we move on, one thing we might want to do is, because Ross, you and I haven't talked about, I mean, we've kind of made, I think, some references, particularly when we were talking about Mark 13 as a little apocalypse. But it might be worthwhile to just say, what does this word apocalypse mean, and you know, what might be gestured toward it, because, or what might it be gesturing towards, because as Andy pointed out, this has become a big discussion in scholarship in the 20th century. New Testament scholarship has, you know, from the late 19th into the early 20th century, began really saying you can't understand the New Testament unless you understand apocalypse and apocalyptic thinking. And then almost hand in hand with that, theology within the church started talking about how our theology needs to be apocalyptic. Although I think, you know, the two mean different things when discussed in that way. But Ross, could you kind of just give a brief kind of, what do we mean when we talk about apocalypse or apocalyptic?
Yeah, I'll just mention some general characteristics of apocalyptic literature that are applicable, I think, across the board. One emphasis is this collision between the old age and the new age. And there's a kind of dualistic element to apocalyptic writing, which pits opposites against each other. So the reign of God versus the reign of Satan, light versus darkness. But one of the main dualistic or pairs that are contrasted are the old age and the new age. And the prophets, prophetic literature also talks about the new age, but there's a distinction in the apocalyptic literature. There's a sense that the new age is breaking in from the future as opposed to something that's developing from our own present. I think another element of apocalyptic is it tends to be written by communities who are suffering, who are under pressure. If you're living well and you're comfortable and happy, there's really not much of a motivation to write about the end of this current age and the coming of the new age. But if you're under intense persecution and suffering, then there's a longing for God to bring in the new age. So old age, new age, suffering, and then also the vindication of God. This is a big theme in apocalyptic literature, that when God does, in fact, usher in the new age, the righteous will be revealed, the evil will be punished, and God will vindicate his own honor and also vindicate his servants. So those are a couple of two or three kind of big themes. There's a lot of symbolism often in apocalyptic literature, kind of code language, where things are taken at several different levels. And often apocalyptic literature was anonymous, although John certainly does not fit, or Revelation, as Andy's already pointed out, does not fit that dimension. But it was often written rather than preached, or sort of comes to us in written form in its first iteration. Hope that helps.
Yeah, I think that's great. And this word apocalypse comes from a Greek word, apokalypsis. How would you translate that, Ross?
The idea of unveiling, of God removing the veil so that we see the things that are to come. And Revelation actually talks about that. And this is the apocalypse, the unveiling of what is to come. An image that I like to use, this is a little bit of an interpretive license, but it's the experience you have if you go to the theater, or when we used to go to the theater before the pandemic, and you're in the sitting in the theater and you see the stage, and then all of a sudden the house lights go down, and there's that moment where the curtains open and you're taken into a new world. And I often think of apocalyptic as that way. And John himself talks about heaven being opened, and there's almost a sense that a hand is being reached down and ripping open the top of the vault that separates us from the heavens, and we're able to sort of look up and look into the future. So I think that that has always sort of captured it for me.
Yeah, no, that's a great image of what the word means. And so this is actually helpful because I think in popular parlance, when people talk about something being apocalyptic, what they typically mean is it has to do with the end of the world. And for them, that just means some great big cataclysmic event that wipes out all of life or most of life and all of civilization. And that's not necessarily, though apocalyptic literature often talks about a transformation of from one age to a new age, or from, you know, a transformation of the world from one way of being to a new way of being. It's not really just a destruction of the world for the sake of the destruction of the world. So Ross, thank you for kind of clarifying that language. Andy, one of the things that Ross mentioned was that when the hand comes and pulls back the veil of this world, often what are seen are images that are hard to understand and have multiple meanings. And it turns out, this is why I keep calling Andy the expert when we talk about the Book of Revelation, because Andy has written a book on based on his dissertation just on this, and that's the title of that is The Book of Revelation and the Visual Culture of Asia Minor, A Concurrence of Images. And I would love to be holding up a copy, but several times I've checked Amazon and it's still just too much for my budget. He's gonna grab a copy, great. There it is. So
yep. Hold on. Yeah, you got it.
We got it. Yeah. So, I'll put up the name when I edit the video. But Andy, tell us about the weird images that show up, especially beginning with chapter 4. And how are we to understand these? I mean, is Tim LaHaye, is he right in the late great Planet Earth and in the Left Behind series? Does he have the right interpretation here?
You know, you started with how are we to understand these images, and I was gonna go back to John Hayes again and say, well, we don't know. But then you said Tim LaHaye. I'm like, well, we do know. That's wrong. Anyway, I'll tell you where my research led me the Book of Revelation. What we get interested in Revelation, it's a fascinating book. It's also a bit terrifying. Like, just because it's fascinating doesn't mean we love it and want to snuggle up with it along with our pillow or something. But the book begins, I think, in a very telling fashion. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants. And this language of to show and to see and to behold is all through the Book of Revelation. So quite apart from whatever its genre might be, the Book of Revelation is fascinating in part because it's such a visual book. And when I do parish studies on Revelation or something, I very often will have us go through an exercise of closing our eyes and just listening, because the original audiences would have heard this, not read it on a page. And then reading aloud some of these visions. And the way it works on the imagination is just remarkable. And so I think the reason for this imagery is it's so vivid because then it's memorable and it really captivates our imagination in a way that kind of Paul's letters might not. And Hebrews actually has a similar sort of captivating effect, but it's a little bit more in the ear. It's a little bit more based on a cache of scriptural images, scriptural phrases. But here, this is all about imagining something with the mind's eye and kind of captivating the imagination, again, kind of toward Christ, as it were. So another thing that happens a lot in the images and what scholars will often do with them is try to decode them. We could look at Revelation 17, and we've got this, the so-called great whore who rides upon the beast. And I saw a woman, this is 17 verse 3. So one of the angels carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness. Notice this too, that throughout the book, John is being carried away by an angel or by Christ or by God in the spirit into a wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was clothed in purple and scarlet. And so we want to know, you know, what is this seven heads and 10 horns? And this is all through the book, right? Also in, we have these four living creatures that are full of eyes in front and behind. And what is all of this? And so some scholars want to try to decode these. Like, well, this whore, the great whore, as she's called, is sitting on the beast that has seven heads. Well, these are clearly the seven hills of Rome, and 10 horns. These 10 horns are clearly 10 emperors. And that's sort of confirmed in the text itself. In verse 9, this calls for a mind that has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. Also, they are seven kings, of whom five have fallen. So just a brief entree here to one image. And we see that on the one hand, it strikes the imagination because it's just this strikingly visual image that your imagination puzzles over, trying to put the pieces together so that you've got seven heads and 10 horns. Your mind, you know, the imagination doesn't quite get there, but it's trying, it's grasping at it because it's such a vivid picture. And then when John comes to, or the angel comes to describe what the image represents, I like this one a lot because most scholars are like, well, they have reference. And so it's really just a kind of coded allegory for what John is and his communities are going through. And while there's aspects of that, notice how the seven heads have two different reference here. There are seven mountains on which the woman is seated, and there are seven kings. So the image is what is important for John. Decoding it can go in multiple directions. This is one of my cautions against overreading the images in too determined of a way. The images, what are they doing? I think mostly they are drawing us in, and they are creating for the audience a world that is not the world we're living in. It's a little bit fantasy, but it's not escapist fantasy exactly. That would take a whole lot longer to unpack, but it is building a kind of Christian imagination, honestly, in a lot of the same ways that Hebrews was doing, but with a much different palette, shall we say.
So
I could keep going, but I better not.
That's great. Because I think you're right. I mean, that the temptation, not just for scholars, but for any Christian who's brave enough to turn to the back of their New Testament and start reading. The question that they want to ask is the one that I addressed to you. What do these things mean? And
right.
And you know, I think what we want is a chart You know, we want our decoder right. ring that we get in the mail after sending in enough, you know, proofs of purchase of some cereal. And then we can use that decoder ring to figure out what all this is meaning. So what you're telling us is that you know, the text is polyvalent. It invites different readings, but the main thing is to have our imaginations captured mm-hmm. for the Lamb who sits upon the throne. Is that right? Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, pretty okay. much. And in the direction of hope. I think this is one difference between Revelation and Hebrews is Revelation is pointing to a future that we can't see and trying to get us to see it in this very fantastic sort of medium that tells us about the present, but also points us to an ultimate and welcome victory of God.
So it's not a text that we should be trying to decode so that we can match up events right now or at some time with the images in the text, but it does give us a future hope, and I'm going to use a word that you might one of y'all might need to unpack here, an eschatological a hope for the future. Would you say what eschatology is? And then, you know, one of y'all address what kind of community needs to hear this message?
I'm gonna let Ross take it.
Okay.
Well, Andy, I think you really have the technical up-to-date definitions or information on eschatology, but it refers to end times, the end things, you know, the end of the world as we know it. And there are eschatological dimensions to many of the Old Testament prophets, but apocalyptic is a slightly different take, as we said earlier, this idea of the New Age breaking in. I think I'll leave it at that. Now, do you want to give us a bit more of the precise definition of eschatology?
No, I think that's great. Eschatology refers to the last things or which could be the end of time, could be the end of the world as we know it. There are lots of ways to construe eschatology, but you're right. Yeah, apocalyptic has its own sort of texture, shall we say, in terms of eschatology, which is where we get some of this notion of cataclysm from, because the book of Revelation, at least in its eschatology, envisions a certain amount of cataclysm along with the eventual triumph of God. You know, there are the great war in heaven and so on and so forth. But some of that is also past, right? That the dragon was already cast out of heaven in the narrative frame and things. And so we're kind of drawn in to a story that we have some sense of the arc of, but it's so removed from our kind of everyday experience of the world. That's the fantasy part of it, that we're kind of drawn into the middle almost of this story that we realize now has been going on for a long time, that the diabolical powers in the world that are against us right now, whether that's in our perception or reality, we could talk more about, you know, to what extent was there empire-wide persecution when the author's writing, we don't really know. But clearly they are undergoing some sort of trials and tribulations and discord with the larger society of which they're part. And those diabolical powers that are making that happen have been active for a while and we didn't know it. So we're drawn into the middle of this kind of celestial story that also helps us make sense of or help the original audience at least make sense of the world they're living in, and to understand that the perception of the world as diabolically motivated and filled with demonic powers that are just against us and are trying to kill us is not the end of the story by any means. It's just the middle, if that, you know, or maybe maybe we're late in the game, but more, there's more of the story than we know. And that's the unveiling, to reveal the history that you think you know here is actually part of a larger celestial history that's being played out.
Yeah, I really look forward to reading your book, Andy. It sounds like a wonderful contribution to scholarship and also to those of us who are preaching through Revelation. And I wanted to just try out an idea on you and see if this fits with what you're saying in regard to your caution about not trying to decode inappropriately. At the same time, there seem to be some pretty clear connections. For example, the city of Rome being referred to as Babylon or the Great Whore. I think a lot of scholars would say that, you know, there's an appropriate or an important way to approach Revelation is to try to understand it on the terms or in the terms in which the original hearers would have understood it. But then also, I think one wants to, especially as a preacher, see how this arcs into our present. And so one way to do that might be to say that there are Rome-like tendencies in certain aspects of modern urban culture that what's being said about Rome in Revelation has a kind of forward movement and application. Would that be an appropriate way of decoding, but also landing into our present?
Yeah, I think not all decoding is bad. There's some in the book itself, it encourages it. I mean, even in that passage that I read briefly, John, the angel is decoding the vision for the audience just in a couple of different ways. And I think one of the tricky things is leaving the meaning open, even if you're decoding, so that we don't say this is just what it means. So this is always about Rome. I mean, that's a good example. A city, the seven mountains. First of all, the hills of Rome were never really called mountains; they were called hills. But in Enoch, in First Enoch, I forget the exact citation, Jerusalem is called a city that sits on seven mountains. So there's actually, it's a very minority report; like almost nobody goes in on this. But there are a couple of scholars who want to argue that Babylon is actually Jerusalem. The city that crucified our Lord, that could be Rome, but it just as easily, or in which our Lord is crucified, I forget exactly the phrasing there, but it could just be Jerusalem. So decoding it without letting the images remain open for as an instrument for understanding our times, I think that's what Tim LaHaye and company get wrong, is they try to close it off. They try to say, well, this is what it means, and this is what we need to look for when the rapture comes and all that, which, by the way, is a hodgepodge of a bunch of biblical verses made up by John Nelson Darby. But that's a whole other story, for which, here's something you can pop in the video, Nick, read Barbara Rossing's The Rapture Exposed. The first chapters on that, she walks you through exactly how that theology of the rapture kind of came to be. But decoding it in a way that says, okay, because the question is how do we remain faithful in a situation where the society around us might not be encouraging us to be faithful and to be true witnesses? How do we retain the strength of our witness in the temptation to accommodate to the society that we're living in, whether that's by coercion, as many of those reading Revelation seem to be feeling, or just by temptation, which is also throughout the book. You know, the Babylon is presented as a great harlot for a reason. She's inviting, she's alluring, and it's not all coercion. And John is maybe not quite sectarian, but says, but look, you've got to be faithful first and foremost to Christ, because this is the real history that's going on right now. And so yes, insofar as our society draws us away from Christ in a Roman direction, sure, possibly in a Jerusalem direction, whatever that means, would take a lot of unpacking. that must be resisted, and being faithful to who we are called to be as God's people is first and foremost.
I really appreciate this discussion. I wish it could keep going. But I know both of you have things you have to get to, and it's about 10 till, which is when you need to already be gone. Can I ask one last question, and this will be it, and we'll kind of wrap it up here. But you know, this book, the Book of Revelation, is famous or infamous as one of the books that Martin Luther wanted to you know, or was not confident about its place in the canon, which is something that he got from Saint Jerome, who produced the Vulgate. Luther wasn't confident about it, though it was the only book in the New Testament that he illustrated so that he could place a papal crown on the Pope's crown on the beast. But that aside, this book did have some trouble in terms of gaining acceptance as part of the canon. And since this series is how did we get the New Testament, I wondered, Ross, is there anything that you wanted to mention about this? And if not Ross and Andy, about its kind of troubled past in terms of getting into the canon, and yet why it is in the canon and why that is meet and right.
Just a couple of observations. It's interesting, the different objections to Revelation in the early church. As a bishop of Alexandria, Dionysius, mid-third century, who was upset that his clergy were getting into too much chiasm. It was a technical term for an obsessive concern with the return of Christ. So, you know, nothing's new under the sun. That's been going on for a long time. And it was because this was going on among his clergy that he was concerned about Revelation. And in order to disprove its to cause questions about it, he showed the contrast between the style, the Greek style of Revelation and the Gospel of John. So it's just interesting how actual practical issues in the life of the church have kind of put pressure on people to raise questions about Revelation. I'm interested in, Andy, your take on this.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's eventually why it had trouble. But actually what we find is that Revelation early was widely cited and well beloved by many, it seems. That's not based on canon lists, but on the people who cited it, the people who quoted it. It was pretty popular. We still have pretty good and early manuscript evidence for Revelation as compared to some of the other New Testament writings, which isn't always saying much because manuscript evidence is generally later than we'd like it to be. But it seems to be fairly widespread very early on. And it was apparently the kind of obsessive interpretation of it toward, you know, when is Jesus coming back? And, you know, the kind of obsessive decoding of our situation in light of Revelation that led to a number of social troubles within the church and within church leadership that seems to have pushed it a little out of the comfort of a number of bishops and ecclesiastical authorities. And it was always difficult for your average Christian to understand anyway. This great bit from Dionysius of Alexandria, who's from the third century and is quoted in Eusebius of Caesarea's Ecclesiastical History from the fourth century. He says, some indeed of those before us, and keep in mind, he died in the middle of the third century, so it's not that much, historically speaking, later than the book. Some of before us rejected and wholly discounted the book, examining it chapter by chapter and calling it unintelligible and illogical, and saying that its title lies, for they say it's not John's, nor is it an unveiling, since it is thickly and heavily veiled by a curtain of unintelligibility. This is how I think Revelation succeeded nevertheless. I think there are a number of people who are like, we don't understand it. It doesn't make any sense. So why is it in the canon? which is probably where a lot of us still are today, honestly. But and he says, I should not be so reckless as to reject the book. And this after he's also talked about differences of style and so on and so forth. Since many of the brethren, the believers, are devoted to it, rather, deeming its character greater than my own powers of wisdom, I judge the interpretation of the various passages to be hidden and more awe-inspiring. For even though I may not understand, still I suspect some deeper purpose undergirds the words, not because I measure and judge these things by my own powers of reason, but because assigning to faith the greater value, I have reckoned them higher than what I am able to comprehend. And I do not reject these things which I am unable to understand, but I rather marvel that I did not see them. And I think now that it's in the canon, if there's a way to approach the book, it's exactly this. To go back to my Old Testament teacher, to be willing at any point just to say, well, we don't know. What does this mean? Does this mean Jesus is coming back Tuesday? Well, we don't really know. But the ability to marvel, the ability to sit in wonder at these visions and as they're given to us, and the humility of Dionysius to place faith higher than that is inspiring. All that said, the book of Revelation, after a little bit of contestation because of these extreme prophetic groups and so on and so forth, did make it into the canon, even though I think it's true that it has had a bit of an uneasy relationship ever since. We get some words and phrases, for instance, in the Book of Common Prayer. We get some canticles out of it, but the lectionary it's pretty sparse in terms of using Revelation. Revelation is used very sparingly in the lectionary.
Well, thank you so much, Andy, for joining us. I know you need to go, and so does Ross, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up here, but I really appreciate the time and expertise that you brought to the conversation. Ross, thank you. I know you had some technical difficulties getting on this time, and so I appreciate you persevering, maybe we can all do this again someday, this has been a great conversation. So Andy, thank you. Ross, thank you. Ross, you're muted.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Nick. It's been a real joy.
Oh, thank you both. This has been fun. Yes, if we need to do a part two, I'm game.